Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on Sunday, April 3rd. But I confess, this is a pre-recorded show. We're doing it a few days before we get on air, so we do not know the outcome of the basketball game. But we're going to be doing a review of all the great media policy issues being fought over in the country today, and especially in Washington, D.C., and we're going to be joined by the foremost authority on that subject, Ben Scott, the policy director for Free Press, the National Media Reform Organization, today on Media Matters, so please do join us. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The United States Supreme Court heard two cases on March 29th that will determine both the future of broadband internet access and just what sort of content will be available online. The access case, Brand X Internet Services versus FCC, involves a California-based company seeking to offer unbundled broadband service over cable systems. Present FCC policy allows cable companies to keep their networks to themselves, even though the Telecom Act of 1996 requires networks that offer telecommunications services be opened to competition. Andrew J. Schwartzman is president and CEO of the Media Access Project and was on hand for the Supreme Court argument. He says it's very dangerous to predict the outcome of the case based on the hearing, but he's cautiously optimistic.
The court certainly expressed its understanding of our central argument, which was that the FCC was trying to evade a congressional deregulation scheme by taking deregulation into its own hands.
The FCC's argument is that cable systems sell their services in bundles. TV and broadband come as a package which can't be split in two, although there's no evidence to suggest such a split is a technical impossibility.
Justice Scalia asked, if I'm selling windshield, could you make me buy windshield wipers? And that argument really goes to the heart of the points we were trying to make. So we took some hope from that.
The same day as the Brand X debate, the court heard arguments in a lawsuit pitting entertainment conglomerates against file-sharing software developers. That case, MGM versus Grokster, questions whether the makers of file-sharing programs should be held liable for any copyright-infringing activity users may engage in. Controlling law at the moment involves a 1984 Supreme Court decision about the liability of VCR makers. Back then, the court ruled that just because a technology may give people the potential to duplicate copyrighted content does not condemn its use. Annalie Newitz, a policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, says the Grokster case is about more than just content piracy. It's about the viability of technological innovation.
Do we want an environment where companies, small entrepreneurs, have to hire a fleet of lawyers before they develop new kinds of applications for media technology?
The Consumer Federation of America's research director, Mark Cooper, believes that regardless of the case's outcome, we haven't seen or heard the last of this issue.
If the court does the right thing and upholds the lower court ruling, then it'll be the recording companies who run to Congress. We have to be ready for that. If the court does the wrong thing, then we're the ones who need to go to Congress. But either way, it's the next battle that's the most important, not the last one.
Rulings in both cases are expected by the end of June.
The FCC is considering expanding the low-power FM community radio service it started 5 years ago. A new Notice of Proposed Rulemaking seeks to undo some of the restrictions placed on the service by Congress at the behest of commercial and public broadcasters. As part of this proposal, the FCC implemented a six-month freeze on the processing of FM translator station applications. Translators are similar to LP-FM stations in that they both are limited to low power levels, but translators simply rebroadcast another, usually non-local signal. The freeze comes in part due to recent revelations that a small group of people manipulated the FCC's application process to get thousands of construction permits to build translator stations, which they are now selling to the highest bidder. Hannah Sassaman, an organizer with the Prometheus Radio Project, says if the rulemaking becomes a rule, the value of translators would plummet as their status on the airwaves relative to other stations is revised.
the FCC asked, should we be giving low-power FM stations, locally fed, locally run and produced, real community outlets of democratic media, primary status to translators fed from a few thousand miles away?
The FCC will soon solicit public comment on its LPFM expansion plan, but Sassaman says action is still at least a few months away because the agency's new chairman, Kevin Martin, needs time to settle in.
Martin has said that no major staff-level decisions about the licensing of radio stations or TV or anything at the Media Bureau level can be made without his go-ahead. He is basically putting the kibosh on any great leaps forward that could happen at the staff level while he becomes acclimated to his new seat.
As of the end of March, 590 LPFM stations were on the air nationwide.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you on April 3rd, 2005, this lovely Sunday. And we're going to be talking, as always, about media and media policy. And we're going to be joined on the phones from his office in Washington, D.C. by Ben Scott, the policy director for Free Press, the National Media Reform Organization, who is actively working really on the full range of media policy issues in Washington today to give us an update on what's going on this year there on the crucial issues. Ben, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
And for some of our more astute longtime listeners, we'll recall that Ben Scott was the original producer of Media Matters during our first year, year and a half on the air. So he's on the other side of the microphone now. How does it feel over there?
Well, you know, I feel like I'm a real bootstrap story here, Bob.
I think you've made it to the top. Yeah, you certainly started at the bottom. I should say that in front of our other producer, Victor Picard. Well, let's go. There's some great issues, Ben, that you've been working on at Free Press that I know our listeners are very concerned about. Let's go through some of them on the show today and where they're at and how people can get involved if they're interested in these issues. First of all, probably the media issue that's gotten the most publicity in the last year has been this whole issue of indecency. Starting with Janet Jackson's nipple and Howard Stern's terminology and activities, and efforts by the FCC and now Congress to regulate and fine indecent broadcasting. Why don't you give our listeners, if you would, just sort of an update on what's happening or a summary of what's happened and where things stand right now?
Sure. Well, as you said, there's been a huge increase in the number of complaints that the FCC has received over the last 18 months or so. On questions of indecency. It's not a new law. The laws have been on the books for quite some time, and the FCC has sort of loose standards that they apply on a case-by-case basis when viewers and listeners of television and radio programs file complaints about what they consider to be indecent content. Under the existing laws, the FCC can assess a fine of up to $32,500 per indecent incident. That's bad language or sexuality or violence, although mostly bad language and sexuality are the ones that draw the fines. The issue has gotten a lot of attention because it's been politicized here in the last 18 months, I think.
And what has Congress done on this?
Congress has taken this issue up. They took it up in the last Congress in the middle of 2004. To raise the fines on indecency, there was a lot of discussion about who ought to be fined, whether it was the broadcaster that ought to be fined, or whether the individual performer ought to be fined, how much money they ought to be fined, what was a proper deterrent. They dragged a bunch of the broadcast CEOs in front of congressional committees and grilled them about their bad taste and indifference to family values of America. And then they didn't get around to passing a bill last time around, but they... This time, in 2005, the House of Representatives just recently passed a bill by an overwhelming margin. I think there were only 38 votes against it, that raised the amount of money that a broadcast station could be fined from $32,500 to $500,000 per incident.
Now, who would make the call on whether something was indecent or not?
That would be the FCC.
And was there some, like, commissar of values there who's in charge of this, or have they figured out who makes that decision at the FCC? Because there are a couple thousand people who work there.
That's true. Basically, this is handled out of the Enforcement Bureau, and the Enforcement Bureau will take a look at the incident that has been reported as indecent and make a judgment about whether or not it is in fact indecent based on the statutory regulation, and they'll pass that recommendation up to the commissioners on the 8th floor at the FCC, and the commissioners will make a decision.
Now, are the commissioners in favor of this in general? Is this something that the FCC is excited about getting involved in?
It's an issue of some delicacy at the FCC. Michael Powell, the outgoing chairman, basically started out his career by saying the FCC should not be America's nanny, and they shouldn't be in the business of fining broadcast stations for what they air in the marketplace. Towards the end of his tenure, he became more interested in indecency fines, some say for political reasons. He had a little flip-flop. Michael Powell, hate to use that well-worn term, but it's, I think, apt in this case. He's certainly joined in his new zeal for assessing indecency fines by Kevin Martin, who was then a commissioner and is now the chairman. Kevin Martin, I think, is perhaps the most aggressive indecency crusader at the FCC, and now that he's in the chairman spot, he'll have a lot of power to push that agenda forward. He's joined in his concern about these issues by the Democratic commissioner, Michael Copps, who's been a champion on his opposition to media consolidation. But Commissioner Copps is from South Carolina and has been very active on issues of indecency and would like to find ways to encourage broadcasters to put more family-friendly content on the airwaves.
Now, Ben Scott, you have worked on this issue yourself and written about it. What is your take on the efforts to find indecent broadcasting? How do you stand on that issue?
Well, I feel like the Congress and the FCC have used this issue to gain political capital, and they're not really trying to solve the problem that is at the root of indecency. I think indecency is a symptom of a larger problem in the media system, just like bad journalism is, and just like a lack of diverse and independent content in the media system is a symptom of a larger problem. And that larger problem is media consolidation. It stands to reason that if you allow a small number of companies to gain control over the broadcast airwaves and the cable system, that they will produce content which is costs them the least amount of money and gets the highest numbers in the ratings, which brings in the most advertising dollars. And the content that gets that's low cost and high ratings is racy TV. It's sex and violence. That's what sells.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're the only game in town, there's nobody else there offering any content because they control the airwaves and the cable systems. There's not many alternatives on the dial.
But what about all these people say, gosh, Ben Scott, there's, 300 stations on the satellite systems. There's something for everyone if you look hard enough.
I dispute that, and I would point to, in particularly in the broadcast networks, there are only four broadcast networks, and they have become shameless in their duplication of one another. I think I can't keep track of how many CSIs are on now and how many Law and Orders and how many reality TV shows that are duplications of last year's success stories. And on the cable dial, I think the latest figures are up 75-80% of primetime content is controlled by six different companies, all of whom are after the same affluent market of 24 to 39-year-olds with expendable income. It's a market that pretends to be diverse and, in fact, offers a very limited set of cultural fare.
So if fines, $500,000 fines on indecent broadcasting is not the way to go, what is the way to go to solve the problem?
I think we have to recognize that the very programming that members of Congress and some commissioners at the FCC would like to lay $500,000 fines on is exactly the same content that's getting number one rankings week after week in the ratings. It's very popular. And I think that our challenge really is to strike a balance between the moral protest of those who feel that this is improper and the public demand for the very same content. I think that it's a mistake to think that you can be against censorship and in favor of family-friendly content at the same time. Those two things are not mutually exclusive, and there are a number of policies that you could put in place that will serve both ends.
We're talking to Ben Scott today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on Sunday, April 3rd, 2005, here in WILL AM 580. This show was pre-recorded a few days ago before going on air after the dramatic victory last week against Arizona, but before the game on Saturday. So we don't know the outcome. You, the listeners, do. Ben Scott, of course, wearing blue and orange. He is a PhD candidate here at the University of Illinois in the Institute of Communications Research, and in his capacity currently as Policy Director for Free Press in Washington. He is joining us today in Media Matters to discuss the range of policy issues and concerning media that we're fighting over in the country today. We've been talking about indecency. Let me remind you that since this is a tape show, don't call in. Sit back. Let Ben Scott and me, Bob McChesney, your host, do all the talking. Ben, before we go back to some of the issues in Washington and around the country on media policy, let's talk a little bit about Free Press, if we can. I should let listeners know, if they're not familiar with this, I was involved in the founding of the group, though I'm not on the staff currently. What is Free Press? What's it all about?
Free Press is a national organization, nonprofit organization, nonpartisan, dedicated to increasing public participation in the media policy debates that shape what we see on TV and what we hear on the radio. It is the only organization of its kind that does national organizing work as well as deeply focused policy work in Washington, D.C., and has media as its sole issue.
And it has a website, is that right, where people can go to learn more about it?
Of course. We have, I think, the best website on media issues, though I may be biased. It's freepress.net. You can visit us at www.freepress.net. We have a great many resources online on a variety of issues.
And Free Press is holding its second national conference in St. Louis this May, is that right?
That's right. Second annual national conference for media reform will be held in St. Louis, May 13th to 15th. We're expecting it to be a huge event that will offer a great many panels and speeches and workshops and a general good time to media activists and scholars and media producers alike.
How many folks do you expect? I mean, there was the first one of these in Madison drew 1,500, 2,000. How many folks do they expect in St. Louis?
I think we'll have at least that many and probably quite a few more.
Who are some of the more prominent figures who are going to be attending the conference in St. Louis?
We have a great lineup of speakers who will be participating. Among them will be Al Franken and Naomi Klein, Juan Gonzalez, Jim Hightower, Robert Greenwald, Amy Goodman, George Lakoff, Janine Jackson.
Hey, sounds like the guest list for the show.
It certainly does.
We ought to just take our show down there and do a year's worth of shows down there. And that's May 13th to 15th in St. Louis. And if people want to learn more about the conference, they can just go to the freepress.net website. Is that right?
That's right. freepress.net/conference will get you all the information about the conference, and it'll get you the information about registration. I encourage all the listeners of Media Matters to consider going.
And there's take care of business while we're at it. Just before that St. Louis conference, which is the weekend of May 13th to 15th, there's going to be yet another conference right here in town for people in Champaign-Urbana and East Central Illinois called Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? And you'll be appearing at that too, will you not, Ben?
I will.
And that conference is going to be a lot of fun too. Most of the people coming to it will be heading right down to St. Louis afterwards. But this is a conference that will be open to anyone in the listening audience to come for free, no registration. It will be held at Folinger on Tuesday night and all day Wednesday at the Krannert Center. There will be lots of publicity. And if you're signed up for the Media Matters e-list, we'll make sure you get everything emailed to you. And you can do that by just emailing Victor Picard, our producer, vpickard@uiuc.edu. And Victor will get you hooked up for our weekly messages. But that conference on Tuesday night is going to have Seymour Hersh, Naomi Klein, and Don Henley speaking, and Representative Bernie Sanders. So that's quite a opening lineup there. I mean, you're really stacking up the order. And then the next day, we've got people like Norman Lear, Linda Foley, John Nichols, yourself, Bill Fletcher, Amy Goodman. It's quite a crew that's going to be here right in town for people who can't make it to St. Louis or want to sort of get their warm-up back before they head down to St. Louis.
I think it'll be a fantastic event.
And this is, again, more information on that coming up. Ben Scott, let's talk now about what I think has been the big issue that's broken in the past few months in Washington concerning media and media policy. And it's sort of under the broad rubric of either payola punditry or video news releases and sort of propaganda by the government, government propaganda, surreptitious propaganda. It started with sort of the information that came out. The Bush administration had paid some journalists under the table surreptitiously to produce favorable content on administration policies. Then later it came out that the administration had sort of allowed a flunky of theirs, a supporter of theirs, to be in the Washington press pool to lob softball questions at the president. And then more recently, the New York Times did a major expose which highlighted how the administration has cultivated the production of a vast array of what are called video news releases to be run as legitimate news on TV stations around the country. Is this a problem with this, or is this just business as usual? And what's the Free Press take on it?
We believe this is a huge problem. We believe that any time the government or corporations or any entity produces a quote-unquote news report and that is selling a particular position and passes it off to a broadcast station as if it were an actual reporting, a reporter going out and doing an objective job of getting the story, that's a violation of the public trust. That's not the news media. That's not the marketplace of ideas. That's just polemicists going out and trying to manipulate public opinion.
And what can be done? What has been done about it? I mean, is it hopeless? I mean, these guys run the Congress. They run the White House. Are they going to be stopped, or what can be done?
Well, I mean, we're looking at it from a couple of different points of view. On the one hand, we can say, why are our tax dollars being spent on propaganda that's then pumped back out into the media system to try to persuade us about a variety of issues? We can watch the news and read the newspaper ourselves. We don't need the government trying to tell us what we think. $90 million, I believe, is the figure that they recently released is the amount of money that's been budgeted to the federal agencies to hire PR firms to produce these video news releases or to hire journalists to flack their position.
I mean, that, you know, just to put that in perspective, $90 million, that is more than a third of the total federal allotment for public broadcasting in this country.
Yeah.
And that's an enormous budget.
It's a huge amount of money. So on the one hand, I believe that that's a misuse of federal tax dollars just in and of itself. And because it impacts the media system, it's an issue that we care very much about. On the other hand, you know, the defense that the federal government has put up is the following, and they're responding to a study done by the Government Accountability Office, which is the agency that looks after the government, makes sure they're not breaking any laws. The GAO came out and said, this is illegal. You can't hire people to do propaganda. It's against the law. You can't use federal dollars for that. So what they said was, look, you know, we do these video news releases, but they're purely for informational purposes. They're well-labeled. And if broadcasters use these and they don't put the labels on there alerting viewers that they're watching a government-produced video news release, then that's not our problem. It's the broadcasters trying to do news on the cheap and substituting our propaganda for their what should be their reporters. Now, that's a sort of disingenuous argument. Why do you spend $90 million if you don't expect people to use it? But be that as it may, that lays some of the blame at the door of the broadcasters.
How have the broadcasters responded?
A lot of the broadcasters have denied that they're doing it. Others have kept very quiet about it. After this New York Times report came out, essentially exposing several hundred broadcasters with their hands in the cookie jar, I think there's a lot of consternation in the broadcast world about what to do about this. People are obviously very angry. It's not unprecedented. We should be clear about that. This White House and the agencies under their control are not the first to use video news releases. They are, however, increasing the budget and using this service in a way that no other administration has ever done before. We're at a qualitative level of news manipulation that we've never seen before.
You know, I know a lot from talking about media and politics over the course of my life that if there was one issue when I would talk to political conservatives that would always push their buttons, the thing they disliked is the idea of the government having anything to do with media. The idea of government propaganda, they considered that synonymous with communism, you know, the government's trying to force people to think certain ways. So here you've got an issue of government surreptitious propaganda, blatant and admitted. How has the conservative community responded on this issue?
Oh, they're very divided. The libertarians who have that political perspective of stay out of my business and don't tell me what to do they're very upset about this. And I think that you'll see them get even more vocal if the administration continues.
Who are some of the – can you put some names on this crowd? Who are these libertarians?
Sure. I mean, the prominent – the usual suspects out there who – you know, the Cato Institute, I think, comes to mind.
But anyone in Congress, any like prominent Republican senators slamming his fist on the table?
Not exactly. I mean, that's the flip side of this, is that because of the political environment here in Washington and the party discipline of the Republicans as they have control of all the branches of government, there really has been a lot of silence on this. There's been a great deal of effort by prominent Democratic senators to launch investigations, to find out where this money is going, how it's being spent, what has been produced, who sent what video news releases where, how many were they aired with the proper attribution. None of these questions have been answered.
Not to interrupt you, Ben, but it would be interesting to speculate what would happen if Bill Clinton or President John Kerry spent $90 million to promote what were regarded as liberal policies surreptitiously in the news media if the same Republicans would be so quiet.
It would be a huge scandal, clearly.
I think it would probably drive someone from office, frankly.
Somebody's head would roll for sure, and talk radio, including your show, I hope, would be up in arms about this. I think, you know, it's purely a matter of this is what happens when one party controls all branches of government. When the executive agency overreaches and commits an offense which its own government accountability agency calls illegal propaganda, and the Congress does nothing.
And I think that's a point worth mentioning, because if the Democrats, for example, controlled one of the branches of Congress, House or Senate, as the Republicans did during Clinton, they would have the power then to commission hearings.
Absolutely.
And they would commission hearings, and this would be a major issue.
If the Democrats were in control of the Senate, we would already have had half a dozen hearings on this issue. It would have been a news story every single night on cable networks and on the broadcast networks, because there were hearings to cover, because the CEOs of the broadcast stations were dragged before the Congress because an independent investigation found that eight stations in the Washington, D.C. area were using these fake news reports. And those station managers would be brought before the Congress, and they would have to account for themselves. Those would be news stories. People would know a lot more about this, and I think it would be impossible to stop the momentum to put the kibosh on any further propaganda.
We're talking to Ben Scott, the policy director for Free Press, the National Media Reform Organization, today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you on Sunday, April 3rd. And I want to remind our listeners, we taped this show on, I think it's Wednesday today, 4 days before going on air. So please do not try to call in. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. We'll be back at you with live shows for the balance of April and into the summer. But today we do have a taped show. Ben Scott, we've got two or three big issues that have really put media policy on the map in the last few years. LPFM radio, low power radio is one. And then most importantly, probably has been the whole question of media ownership and the campaign in 2003 to stop the Federal Communications Commission from relaxing longstanding media ownership rules or even eliminating them. Now, to catch our listeners up to speed who have been paying close attention, the courts threw out the efforts of the SEC to relax those media ownership rules last year in 2004. What is the status of these important media ownership rules today, and where are they going to go in the next few months?
Well, that's a question that a lot of people would like the answers to, including myself.
And our listeners.
Basically, when the courts threw out the ruling and said to the FCC, you know, you did such a bad job studying this question, and you so obviously tried to cook the books in order to get rid of the rules and get rid of the public interest limits on media ownership, that we order you to go right back to the drawing board and start again. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to study this question all over again. You're going to have to solicit a great deal more information from the public, from the different players involved, and then you're going to have to come up with a new set of guidelines and then come back to us and prove to us that you did a good job. The FCC then had a choice. They could appeal that decision to the Supreme Court, or they could go back to the drawing board, just like the court asked them to. There was a lot of speculation that the commission would go to the Justice Department and they would get the government lawyers to appeal the case to the Supreme Court. And the clock ran out on that, and they decided not to appeal that decision. The decision was, however, appealed by a number of the broadcast stations and a number of newspaper companies who also own television stations. They appealed the decision to the Supreme Court. However, the conventional wisdom is that without the support of a Justice Department appeal, the Supreme Court is very unlikely to hear that case.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're very likely to see is the FCC taking up the question again.
And what are the rules that are in play? I mean, what are the important ones that really would dramatically affect the media landscape in this country?
Sure. There are two main rules that we need to consider. One is called the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule, which means currently it's illegal to own a newspaper, a monopoly newspaper, and a broadcast station, a television station in the same town. And that rule is in place because in most markets in this country, if you own the newspaper and the biggest television station, you control a majority of the news and information and the news employees in that market. That law has been on the books for a generation, for good reason. The second major rule that's before the commission is the so-called duopoly rule, and it's called that because it has to do with how many broadcast stations, television stations, can you own in a single market? Can you own one? Can you own two? Can you own three? Currently, you can only own one unless you're in a really large market, and then you can own two. The FCC has been pushing on that rule, and the broadcasters have been pushing on that rule. They'd like to stretch it out to owning two anywhere you want and owning three in the large markets. When you put those two rules together is when you really have the problem, because as then you have the possibility of one company owning a monopoly newspaper and the three largest television stations in one market.
And eight radio stations. And the billboard monopoly.
And the cable system. And an unlimited number of cable networks and an unlimited number of magazines and an unlimited number of websites.
And basically what that means, and this what we're talking about now is not stuff that's being made by critics of the rules changes, but by proponents of it, because they see how profitable this will be.
Absolutely. The way to make the most money in the media business is to own all the media in any given market. Because then you don't have any competitors. You're the only game in town.
Yeah, or your competitors are so weak they can't really mess with you.
That's right. You control not only the best, the most highly rated media properties, but you also control the majority of the news employees. You set the advertising rates in that town. You control what gets on the air and what doesn't.
And understood this way, I think we get a sense why in 2003, to the surprise of a lot of people, this issue resonated across the political spectrum. I mean, it was really one of the astonishing political developments of the last few years was the way that people who wouldn't be considered liberals or people who don't even care that much about politics, and a lot of people who would be self-described conservatives, really protested the idea of letting, you know, one company gobble up all the media in a town.
Absolutely. I think it really gets down to something very fundamental about American democracy. People, as a matter of conventional wisdom, understand that control over information has to be decentralized. It cannot be placed in the hands of a small number of corporations. It cannot be placed in the hands of a centralized government. It has to be in the hands of the people. That more voices in the media system is always better than fewer. I think that's what drove the aggressive opposition to the efforts to remove those media ownership limits. I don't think that sentiment is going away.
You know, Ben Scott from Free Press, you know, as we talk about how the media ownership rules are going to be reviewed again by the SEC coming this year, one of the things that was striking in 2003 was how the Bush administration and the Republican Party leadership was absolutely gung-ho on the side of relaxing these rules. I mean, they made it their mission. They control Congress. They control the White House. They have three of the five members of the SEC. What is there any way they can be stopped this time if the courts don't do the job from getting rid of or relaxing these rules and therefore allowing basically local media monopolies all over the country?
Well, I mean, I think that this issue is unique amongst the majority of the issues that are being considered by the Congress right now, in that there are a number of conservative legislators who oppose media consolidation. And I'd say the majority of the conservative base out in the country, in the red states, they oppose media consolidation.
Yeah, I mean, it's notable that the Bush administration was not loudly screaming its stance on media policy issues in the campaign.
That's right. Nobody wants to take up the cause of creating Big Brother. It's just not a politically popular thing to do. Everybody wants to take the campaign contributions from the media companies, but nobody wants to be publicly associated with what is clearly a bad policy.
Mm-hmm. So you think there's a chance that this can still be stopped despite the power of the those sympathetic to the media, big media companies?
I think so. And I think the reason that is because it's going to take a while to push these issues through at the FCC. The FCC is going to have to, assuming the Supreme Court doesn't take up the case, the FCC is going to have to consider the rules, either as a package as they did before or one at a time. And if they do that, they're going to face a lot of criticism month after month after month as they try to proceed through the through the process.
And it's worth noting that the FCC has five members, and the party in the White House always gets to have the majority. So now it's a Republican majority, but there are two Democrats on it.
That's right. And currently, because of the departure of Chairman Powell and the elevation of Commissioner Martin to the chairmanship, there's an open seat on the commission that has not yet been filled. Currently, there are two Democrats and two Republicans, and Kathleen Abernathy, who is the second Republican member, has indicated that she will leave the commission. So there will come a time here shortly when there are three members on the commission and there are two vacant seats.
Now, how do these commissioners, are they appointed by the president? I mean, do they have to go through any sort of public review to get this job, considering how important it is? Do they, are they analyzed and scrutinized?
They should be. They are appointed by the president. Any new commissioner who's appointed by the White House will have to face a Senate confirmation hearing. However, a commissioner who is already a sitting commissioner, like, for example, Kevin Martin was before he was elevated to chairman, has already been through the Senate confirmation process when he was appointed commissioner. So when the White House makes him chairman, he is exempted from the need to go back to the Senate and go through another grilling before the confirmation committee.
But they're traditionally these guys, and they're mostly guys and gals on occasion, they have not really, the public hasn't really been too engaged in sort of reviewing them like a Supreme Court justice or something when they're up before the Congress.
Basically zero. I mean, I think the public awareness of who gets appointed to a federal agency like the Federal Communications Commission is next to nothing.
You know, and it's worth adding for listeners who might not be aware of this, but the members of the Federal Communication Commission are not like the Securities and Exchange Commission or the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, since they give out these monopoly licenses to radio and television and satellite systems and cable systems. They actually are arguably the single most powerful federal agency in terms of economic impact. They control hundreds of billions of dollars in licenses and value. They're not just regulating, they're creating industries.
That's absolutely true. I think one point I can make to indicate just how pervasive their power is if you look at what happened during the 2004 election cycle, there's a woman down in Texas named Becky Klein who was the chair of the Public Utilities Commission in Texas when President Bush was then the governor of Texas. She's very close to the Bush administration, was an advisor of the Bush camp on telecommunications issues. She ran against Representative Lloyd Doggett, who's a congressman from the Austin area, in the 2004 election and was behind in the polls by 20%. It was widely known that she was going to lose, but there was some vague speculation that maybe one day she might have a chair or a commissioner spot at the FCC. As a result, her campaign coffers were packed full of massive donations by every telecommunications and media company under the sun, just on the off chance that she might be appointed one day to the FCC.
Yeah, well, that's business as usual, as we know, at the Federal Communications Commission. We're talking to Ben Scott today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. This show is recorded a few days before going on air, so please sit back, enjoy the show, let us do the talking. Ben Scott is the Policy Director for Free Press, the National Media Reform Group. You can learn more about Free Press at www.freepress.net. And Free Press is sponsoring the second National Conference for Media Reform in St. Louis, Missouri, May 13th to 15th, the weekend. I'll be there. Ben will be there. Lots of people, most of the guests in the show will be there who've been on the show in the last year. You can learn more about it at the freepress.net website. And there will be a small local conference just before the St. Louis Conference right here in town in Champaign-Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois at Folinger and at Krannert Hall. Tuesday night, May 10th, and all day Wednesday, May 11th, called Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Free, open to the public. Anyone in the community is welcome to attend it. We'll have a lot more publicity on it coming up. But at that conference, will people Tuesday night, like Don Henley of the Eagles, Bernie Sanders, the U.S. representative, Naomi Klein, the journalist, Seymour Hersh, the legendary journalist, and Ben Scott will be there, John Nichols, Linda Foley. So stay tuned to that. If you're interested in learning more about that, the best way to do it in the near term is make sure you get on the Media Matters weekly emailing list, and you can do that by emailing our producer, Victor Picard, V-P-I-C-K-A-R-D at UIUC. .edu. Ben Scott of Free Press, one of the issues you've been working on, and Free Press has been working on intensively, is an issue of great interest to people in the area here of Champaign-Urbana, and that's community internet. We've got a lot of listeners, nonetheless, who probably don't know anything about it. Can you give sort of like an ABCs of what we mean by community internet, why it's so important, how it works, and where it stands today?
Sure. I think the place to start with community internet is with the digital divide. A lot of people throw that term around without really understanding exactly what we mean by it. And I think the easiest way to describe it is to look at the numbers. Currently, broadband or high-speed internet access in the United States is at 20%. 20% of households have broadband internet access.
Mm-hmm.
40% of households have dial-up internet access. And 40% don't have internet access at all. 35% of those don't even own a computer. That's a huge digital divide at a moment when in the most advanced technological countries like South Korea and Japan, virtually 100% of households have access to the internet at high speeds.
Mm-hmm. Super high speeds, even.
Super high speeds, even. And as we move into the 21st century, increasingly, if you don't have access to high-speed internet access or broadband, you have a serious disadvantage in the economic marketplace. It's hard to get jobs if you don't have training on computer technologies. Your kids have a serious disadvantage in education. I mean, it's becoming a growing trend where kids who are valedictorians in rural high schools across America go to the major elite universities across the country, and they arrive there to find that they're in a huge disadvantage because they have not grown up with the technologies that are common in urban areas and in more affluent areas in the country. So, why did this happen? You know, why is it that so many people are being left behind? Why is it we have such a digital divide? And the answer is that the broadband market is controlled by two industries, the phone company that offers DSL service and the cable companies that offer cable modems.
And these are almost always monopolies in any specific community. There's not like eight phone companies competing for eight cable companies.
Almost always you have, in almost every country, every place in the United States that has cable or DSL service, you have one choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a phone company and a cable company. And typically, you can't buy that service just on its own. If you want DSL, you're going to have to buy the phone service from the same phone company that offers you the DSL. If you want cable modem, you're going to have to bundle it together with your cable TV. So they sort of lock you in, and they prevent competition in the marketplace by doing that. But they do that for a very good reason, which is so that they can keep prices high. And so the reason why 80% of the country doesn't have broadband are, number one, because a lot of places don't. There is no service offered in their community. And number two, if there is service, it's $50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And $50 a month is a huge expense for most Americans, particularly at a time when the economy has been in recession. People are out of work. The good-paying jobs are on the decline. People are having troubles because they have to suddenly chip in for their own health insurance, pay tax cuts for the wealthy, that kind of thing. Broadband is a luxury item. It's not a commodity that people can afford.
Mm-hmm.
What we believe in our community internet campaign is that broadband internet access ought to be a public utility. It ought to come standard when you get an apartment or house, just like your water or your electricity. You ought to take it for granted that the lowest cost possible broadband service will be available to you no matter where you are, no matter what walk of life you come from, no matter how much money you have in your wallet.
But isn't that impossible? Isn't that technologically, economically unfeasible?
It used to be. It used to be that the reason why that never happened is because you had to have so much money to invest up front in a wired infrastructure. You had to dig up the streets, you had to lay wire, you had to put in a fiber optic system. It was very complex. But in the last few years, there have been amazing developments in wireless technologies, including a great program right there at the University of Illinois, where for a one-tenth or one-hundredth of the upfront investment, you can install wireless transmitters and have a broadband cloud of connectivity over your city where everyone can access it from anywhere for a very low cost. And in Champaign-Urbana, you have the premier public service project that's developing wireless technology, mm-hmm. the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network. I believe the city of Urbana has now become a partner in that project. A number of organizations, the Urbana Business Alliance, have been involved. And this is really a groundbreaking and hugely impressive new movement in technology provision going on right there in your backyard.
Yeah. What does it mean exactly? And, you know, for those of us who aren't really technologically oriented, what in terms of what it delivers, what the system promises, and how it's different from the current system?
Well, imagine that instead of giving a $50 a month bill from SBC for your DSL line, you got a $5 a month bill.
I like that.
From your local Urbana community wireless network.
Uh-huh. But and is it going to be some government bureaucrat then telling me what I can look at and not look at?
Not at all. The community networks are all what are called open access networks. That means the network is neutral. It pays no mind to whatever information you send over it. You can go anywhere you want. You can download it, you know, from any site in a non-discriminatory manner. Nobody's looking over your shoulder. It's just as secure and just as high quality a service as the commercial providers offer, except that it's far lower cost. And the primary reason is that the folks who build community wireless networks are out to serve the public and not to line their pockets. And when you can do that, you can make your dollars go a lot farther.
How can you? I mean, how do you make your dollars go farther?
Essentially, when you invest in the infrastructure and you put up the wireless transmitters and you make the network and people start paying their $5 a month, instead of taking the $2 a month that you're not spending and putting it in your pocket as profit or turning it over to your Wall Street investors for a further increase in your capital, you plow it right back into the network. You improve the service for your local community, or you lower the prices for your end users, so that it's the people in the locality that get the advantage of the system, not the investors.
Now, so does this eliminate the digital divide just because people can afford $5 rather than $50, or is there more to it than that?
Well, the price differential will go a long way towards eliminating the digital divide,
mm-hmm.
but it will also go towards establishing a sense in the community that broadband is not just something you buy if you have the money to drop on a luxury item. It's a public utility. It's something that everybody ought to have. It's a communications right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, where does broadband stand? It's such a great idea. I mean, who could argue against having, you know, $5 a month for an equal or superior service, overpaying $50 a month for a private service? I mean, who could be opposed to that? It sounds like, you know, a tremendous advance for our society.
Well, I mean, the obvious people who are going to be hurt by a system that costs $5 a month are the guys charging $50.
All right. So what are the politics here then?
So what we've seen in the last year and a half are more and more communities deciding to build their own networks. And it's not just a public-only system. A lot of municipalities partner with private providers who build wireless networks. What's happened is the big companies, the cable companies and the phone companies, have gone to the state houses, and they're in Springfield right now trying to push on legislators to offer laws that will outlaw the public provision of broadband, that will make it illegal for a community to decide to serve themselves with low-cost universal access.
On what grounds, other than just blatant greed, could a legislator, you know, condone such an approach?
What they claim is that it's unfair for the public sector to compete with the private sector, regardless of the fact that actually lots of cities are hiring other private providers to actually deliver the technology. They are arguing that this is unfair competition, which is one of the most bogus arguments, even on the surface, that they have ever put forward.
By that logic, wouldn't we cut down the interstate highway system or something?
Yeah, and, you know, the car dealerships ought to be in the Congress lobbying against city buses and taxis.
Yeah, I mean, so that seems like this gets to another point. I know you've spoken about, Ben Scott, in the past about these companies, the phone companies and cable companies. I mean, how free market are they? I mean, are these companies that, you know, earn their stripes independent of government support?
Yeah, I mean, you put your finger on a major issue, which is, you know, the phone companies in particular receive hundreds of millions of dollars of public subsidies every year. So it is the height of hypocrisy for them to turn around and complain about a city going into the broadband business and saying that they're subsidized by the public.
Well, are they these now? So we're in a situation now around the country. State governments are being pressured by very powerful phone companies and cable company lobbies to limit the ability of municipalities to set up their own ubiquitous wireless internet access systems for their communities. How successful have these campaigns been, and what's being done to on the other side to maintain the right of municipalities to set up their own systems?
Well, it's a pretty amazing story. In about 10 different states, phone companies have gone to the state houses and tried to push bills which they thought were going to sail through the legislatures because it's a complex issue on broadband policy that not many people have started.
Yeah, this sort of stuff gets zero coverage in the news media.
Yeah, try reading about this in the News Gazette. It'll be impossible. But, you know, to their surprise, they have met with a fierce resistance. And so far, not a single one of these bills have been passed in any of those states.
What about Pennsylvania, though? I thought they passed something like this.
Well, Pennsylvania passed this bill last year before the campaign was mobilized to prevent this kind of legislation from coming through. I think Pennsylvania really served as a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm. The Fort Sumter?
Exactly. What Verizon did in Pennsylvania was they went to the State House and they passed a bill very quietly attached to a much larger bill. Nobody knew about it. A lot of the legislators that we've talked to in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, said they didn't even know that this provision was on the bill they were voting for. That bill says no city can offer its own wireless network unless it first asks the permission of Verizon. It would be like saying no city can build its own public library unless it first asks permission of Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And they passed that bill.
Except, and this was driven, I guess, as I understand, because Philadelphia had gone forward to set up its own citywide wireless network, and that got Verizon concerned that wanted to snuff that out.
Well, I mean, what Philadelphia is proposing to do is become the first major U.S. city to offer a low-cost or free wireless network to all citizens to close the digital divide in an urban area.
Mm-hmm.
And Verizon sees on the horizon the possibility that people will like that idea.
Yeah.
They don't want to see this thing duplicated anywhere else. So in the end, because even though the bill passed out of the State House before we even knew about it, there was a 10-day period before the governor signed it into law where people found out and raised a ruckus. And in that time period, Philadelphia signed an agreement with Verizon exempting itself from this permission rule. So Philadelphia is going to go forward with whatever they had planned, regardless of the law. But everybody else in Pennsylvania, including Pittsburgh and every other major city, they're completely holding the bag.
And it's worth noting from what I've looked at community wireless that it's not simply large metropolitan areas either. In fact, the areas that are most immediately jumped to this are rural areas that are more or less being ignored by the big companies.
That's exactly right. And I think a lot of the listeners of your program in the Midwest will understand this only too well. There's a great case out in Scottsburg, Indiana, which is just south of Indianapolis, where the mayor was approached by a local car dealership and said to him, "Mr. Mayor, you know, General Motors has gone purely online for the repair manuals, and we need a high-speed connection in order to download them, and we don't have one here. If you don't get us high-speed internet, we're moving to Louisville." And the mayor went to SBC, and the mayor went to Comcast and begged them to bring high-speed internet to Scottsburg, Indiana, and they refused. And they said they didn't have any plans to come to that little town because it was so hard to make money in a small town. So the mayor went and invested in a citywide wireless network, which is built inside of 6 months and is enormously popular, very low cost. And not only has he saved the jobs at the auto dealership, but he's attracted more jobs to town.
So it sounds like you're optimistic that that the proponents of community internet access can stop the efforts of the phone and cable companies to sort of snuff them out in the crib.
I'm absolutely optimistic. I think there are some states where the legislatures are particularly politicized, like Texas, where they may pass an ugly bill. But I think this thing is unstoppable. I think the more communities that follow the lead of Scottsburg, Indiana, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and demonstrate to people that it's not only possible, but it is relatively easy to offer low-cost broadband access to everybody, not just those who can drop $50 a month, that it'll catch on like a wildfire, and any politician caught trying to pass a bill to outlaw it will be burned at the stake.
Now, listeners who are interested in following this issue, getting involved, learning more about it, getting background, where, is there some place on the Internet they can go?
Absolutely. We've put together, I think, the best resource on the Internet, on community Internet, both on how to do the technology and as well as the legislative campaigns, and that's at freepress.net/community internet.
freepress.net/community internet. We're talking with Ben Scott, Policy Director of Free Press Today and Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We've only got a few minutes left in the show, and there's a lot of ground still to cover, Ben, but I do want to touch on one issue before we go, which is this week, arguments were heard before the Supreme Court on a very important copyright case, the Grokster case. And it's an issue that is going to be at the center of the development of media and communication for the next generation, how copyright will be interpreted and developed. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on and what's at stake?
Sure. The Grokster case, which is heard on Tuesday, is essentially about whether or not peer-to-peer networks, which are online systems that allow individuals to share files across the Internet, whether that technology should be held liable for copyright violation if anybody uses their technology to break the law. It's sort of like, should you be held liable, should the VCR companies be held liable if you start taping movies from the video store and selling them yourself? And it's a great big debate because on the one hand, you have artists who feel like their sales at the music stores are being undercut by people downloading files illegally, and they're trying to make a living. And I think no one would want to stand in the way of artists getting just compensation for their creative work. But on the other hand, we have a new technological revolution in communications that, you know, threatens to be completely stunted if the technology, rather than the behavior of the users of the technology, becomes the focus of regulation. And that's the question that was before the Supreme Court on Tuesday.
And what is your position on this, if I may ask, although I'm getting a hint of it?
Well, the way I feel about it is that, you know, absolutely there should be protections for artists, but the way to go about that is not to regulate technologies, because the regulation of technologies on the Internet requires a level of personal surveillance which is simply unacceptable. It essentially, in order to control what information people are sharing across the Internet, you would have to set up a system where every digital transaction went through a central server that had a number tagged to your computer, so that every time you send an email, every time you upload or download something from the Internet, it can be traced right back to you.
We're talking to Ben Scott today on Media Matters. We've just got a few minutes left, Ben, and I do want to just, in the last second, talk about LPFM, low-power FM radio. What's the status of that? I mean, at one time there were going to be thousands or hundreds of new stations authorized to go on the FM dial, local, nonprofit, non-commercial stations. Where does that stand today?
Well, the good news about LPFM is that several senators, including John McCain, have introduced a bill in the Senate to authorize the expansion of the LPFM service to put thousands of more local non-commercial stations on the airwaves. It would be a huge coup for community media everywhere. We're very encouraged about the prospects of that.
Is there bad news, though?
The bad news is that the National Association of Broadcasters are still very much against any kind of community competition on the dial, and they're going to fight this tooth and nail. And they have their man, Kevin Martin, as the chair of the FCC.
And this is an issue, again, I suspect, that is being tracked at freepress.net by Free Press and a number of other activists working on the issue.
Absolutely.
Ben Scott, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. It's been terrific. And for listeners, I wanted to remind you that Ben Scott will be in town talking about these very same issues on May 11th of this year. Stay tuned for that. We'll be back next week with another episode of Media Matters. Goodbye.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASC-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the upper 60s and west winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the upper 30s and light and variable winds. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the lower 70s and southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 40s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.